Hey, Bruiser Buddies, this is Wrestling Nostalgia with Dave Dynasty.
Before we dive into the episode, make sure you hit subscribe on the podcast platform you're listening on. Also, follow me on X at The Dave Dynasty and subscribe on YouTube by looking up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty. You can also buy one of my shirts at ProWrestlingTees.com/TheDaveDynasty. Now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to 1 hour of the toughest, roughest wrestling you'll ever see.
That's right, Dick the Bruiser, set it off.
The big question, have you got the endurance? Have you got the brain to get past the excellence of execution?
Does they think they got the answers? I change the questions.
This is Jim Cornette, and the views that I'm about to express are not necessarily those of anybody else but me, but they ought to be, and as a matter of fact, they probably are.
The reason why Ax and myself were put on this earth is to demolish people.
Bobby Heenan, that is a very good-looking sport coat you've got on.
Yeah, and I paid for mine. Mine is in government issue.
Yellow. Ready, Lance Russell and Dave Brown right along ringside. By golly, we're ready to go with another big week of championship wrestling.
Greetings, wrestling fans, and welcome to Wrestling Nostalgia. I'm your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining me for another episode. Guys, this episode's so much fun. My guest is Jimmy Jacobs. We had a great conversation talking about Midwest independent wrestling in the early 2000s. Plus, of course, plenty of talk about Ring of Honor. So let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have my interview with Jimmy Jacobs.
Filsinger Games is a tabletop cards and dice game company that has enjoyed success for over 3 decades. Their first game was Champions of the Galaxy and was released in 1986. Champions of the Galaxy is a tabletop game that features professional wrestling over 100 years in the future. Humans, aliens, and monsters battle in the Galactic Wrestling Federation for belts. Legends of Wrestling features officially licensed wrestling cards featuring stars like Ted DiBiase, Jimmy Snuka, Harley Race, and many, many more, including game sets for independent promotions. Each match takes place in real time. The action is fast and furious, and all the things that happen in pro wrestling, like cage matches, outside interference, three-man tag matches, they also happen in the games. You have the opportunity to run your own wrestling promotion involving either real-life stars or fictional characters of the future, or you can mix and match both. Visit FilsingerGames.com for more information and to order the games today. That is Filsinger Games, FilsingerGames.com to order now. If you like horror movies, be sure to check out Dave Dynasty and Ike Isaacs on the Listen to Their Screams Horror Podcast. It is available on all podcast platforms and on social media at Listen to Screams. That is Listen, the number 2, and Screams.
All right, and welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. This time I'll be joined by a 5-time Ring of Honor Tag Team Champion and the Zombie Princess, Jimmy Jacobs. Sir, how are you?
I am doing fantastic, Dave. And I just want to let you know, you had messaged me about doing this, and I didn't get back to you. And then the other night, I was on YouTube.
Yeah?
And I was looking up some old wrestling.
Okay.
And then I was watching some WWA Bruiser Bedlam Wrestling.
Well, I wonder whose channel that was.
Wait, whose channel is this? I'm like, yo, that's the guy that hit me up about doing... I got to do this guy's podcast now. So that's what brings us together.
Cool. Well, I mean, a couple of Midwest guys, right? I mean, you're from Michigan, correct?
I am from Michigan. And my best friend is Truth Martini. And he remembers Bruiser Bedlam Wrestling from like growing up.
Yeah.
Like, he remembers watching it on TV. And so we were just like, yo, let's watch some of this Bruiser Bedlam Wrestling. And there it was. They're like, oh, there's Dave Dynasty. Like, that's the guy. I'm like, it is this dude. This is his channel.
It is, right?
What brought you to and I didn't look more fully in the channel.
Yeah.
Is it just the Dick the Bruiser stuff?
Yeah, mostly. I've got a little bit of a little bit of the Sheik stuff from Michigan and stuff like that. But yeah, it's mostly WWE. That's my sweet spot because I'm from Indiana.
Right.
And
that was in Indiana. Like Dick the Bruiser was out of what, like Chicago, Indianapolis.
He was in Indianapolis, right? Yeah. And he ran Chicago with Vern Gagne and stuff as a, like a co-promotion, but yeah, based out of Indianapolis. But then when he kind of got out of it a little bit, he sold it out and it went to Detroit and then Toledo as Bruiser Bedlam. That was kind of the continuation of the WWA.
So he wasn't the guy at that point. They just kept him on as a, yep, as a commentator and yep, someone else was running it.
Yeah. Dr. Jerry Grimm Jr.
Gotcha.
Yep. He ran it with a guy named Sam Botek, who was I think a beer distributor, kind of a money guy involved with it. And yeah, they first moved it to Detroit, ran it there for a little bit, then ended up moving it to Toledo, where that's where Graham's from.
Interesting. But, wow.
Yeah. And it kept on. But yeah, so I have a soft spot for all that because, yeah, I grew up watching that stuff, right? I mean, I remember back watching Bruiser in those late years in the 80s when most people put that stuff down.
Oh, yeah. When I was working in WWE, if you use the term tape or film, when referring to something, if you're like, yeah, we're going to tape this or film this, Vince is like, are we using tape again? Are we using film? It's like, yes.
So where are you at now?
I'm in Michigan. I'm back in Michigan.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Moved back here a couple of years ago.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I get back to Indiana a couple times a year because I've still got they're grown kids, but I got kids and family there.
Yeah.
But I'm from central Indiana. So we're going to talk all about that because there's a lot to talk about that. I don't know how much, hopefully people like hearing it, but there's a lot of stuff that you and I can talk about, I think Midwest related.
Yeah.
That's going to be fun. But I do want to know, first of all, when I entered you in, how did you develop the nickname the Zombie Princess?
Well, so it came from a promo I did. I was wrestling Kevin Steen. I think it's like 2012, March of 2012, February, something like that. I think 2012. Yeah, I think that would be right. Yes. And he had made fun of me because, like, I used to wear eyeliner and mm-hmm, fingernail polish, and he had made fun of me for it. And the promo was something like, I don't need to dress tough or look tough. I am tough. I can put on a tutu and tiara, call myself a princess and still be the toughest guy in the room. Cause right when you think I'm dead, right when you think you've killed me, I come back to life like a zombie.
I'm the motherfucking
zombie princess.
Yeah. I love it.
It points to this sort of energy of, this vile character, but who sort of presents himself as a bit like harmless, almost like, you know, there's a little bit of a femininity to Jimmy Jacobs. Right. And so there's this like, sort of like almost, he's small and he's a bit effeminate, and by his appearance, he shouldn't be dangerous, but underneath the exterior of femininity, underneath the exterior of makeup, underneath that sort of pretty exterior lurks a monster, right? Yeah. And so that's a pretty it's a pretty fundamental trope in reality. It's like the monster dresses up like like a human, right? That's what it is. Satan will show up as the angel of light.
Yeah.
And so it's similar to that pattern.
Yeah. That sounds very Truth Martini-ish. And yeah, for those of us though, like we said, we talked about being from the Midwest. You were one of the guys most talked about, getting a lot of attention in the early 2000s. And we talked about, right, you're from Michigan and you started working right for promotions there. You were just doing whatever you could. That was kind of the thing, right? In the early 2000s, you did whatever you could. I mean, you were commentating, you were a webmaster, you were refereeing, you just did, I'm assuming, whatever you could to get involved in the business.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I have one older brother, he's 3 years older than me, and he wanted to be a pro wrestler. And so he found a school in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He was 17 years old at the time. He was about to be a senior in high school. And I was 14, and I just like followed him around.
Yeah.
And so anywhere anybody would let me do anything, I would, someone just had to put the door ajar just slightly for me to start to bust it down. And so, I didn't know how to make websites at 14, but I learned HTML and HTML, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I learned how to do that. I learned how to do that like 14, 15, so I could be valuable to the wrestlers around me. And then, you know, one of the companies my brother worked for, one weekend, one of the referees was going to be on vacation. So it's like, I can do that. And so I just, any opportunity anybody would give me at all to sort of let my way in the wrestling business, I smashed that door down every chance I could.
Yeah. I did that too, right? I mean, I'm a much, much smaller scared than you. But I remember, right, going to my local show there in Central Indiana. And I went every month, right? And then one month, I just remember talking to the guy who ran it and said, you know, your programs are kind of weak. I'm like, I can do it better. You know, I can make you a better little program. I mean, whatever, just let me in free, right? I'll do that. So I started doing that, right? And then it's like, eventually, it's like, he's like, oh, would you like to do this? Would you like to do that? And then, you know, eventually, oh, would you like to manage? And it just, one thing led to another. And it's weird how that happens, right? If you got that passion, right? It just, you find a way.
That's right.
To be involved. I've always thought, and it's always my mentality with independent wrestling and everything else over the years. It's very punk rock, right? Very DIY.
Yeah.
You'll find a way, right? If you want to be involved, you'll find a way to get, you know, find your little segment and be involved in it.
Yeah. And what I've found, personally over the years, being on, you know, wearing a lot of different hats, is generally speaking, if people show that they care and want opportunity and put in the work to get opportunity, like, people are generous. Like, yeah. People want to help, especially, like, I find that successful people, like, yes, successful people can be, like, let's say, busy, but that they're generous with their persons. Like, they want to help people who show that they are worth the time to help. And yeah. So early on, I had a lot of people, you know, I was 15, I was undersized, undertrained, undertalented, underaged. And I still had people that that helped me out because I was willing to do whatever. I was willing to make people's lives easier too. And yeah. As someone who's sort of been on the other side now, as someone who's been in the office and weighs in on hiring people and things like that, and, you know, is, you know, higher up in certain companies at different times, I loved people that made my life easier.
Sure.
I loved it. If you were the kind of person that, like, went out of your way to make my life easier, like, of course I want you around. Who doesn't want people sure. around?
Yeah.
That make their lives easier. Like that. So that's my, yeah. I think one, people are generous, especially successful people, to those that show that they're worthy of the time, you know, like worthy of the effort of someone else's effort. And that if you make yourself valuable to other people, that value will be reciprocated in how they treat you.
Sure. I agree. Yeah. And like you said, eventually, right, it did progress to you wrestling. And where did the name Jimmy Jacobs come from?
That's a funny one too. So it was one of my backyard wrestling names.
Oh.
And so when I started as a referee, and I thought it sounded like an unassuming referee name. So it's like, yeah, referee Jimmy Jacobs. So it was a name that was meant to not stick out. And I don't know why I kept it. I've sort of rued that day for many years, probably. In about 2005, when I was starting to, you know, I'd broken out of the indies a bit at that point.
Yeah.
I started to wish, I just wish I would have just wrestled as the Princess. Like at that point, at 21, I would have just changed my name to the Princess or Princess, you know, like Prince, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Princess. And just gone in on that, as opposed to having this sort of unassuming name and then adding monikers with it. And I'll tell you, Kevin Sullivan, when I was doing the Bruiser Brody, mini Bruiser Brody and a Huss on my tights,
he
was like, yo, you should just be Huss. That should be your name, just Huss. Sandman, when I was 21, we were watching a match of mine and he was putting it over and he's like, you need like a one word name, like Raven or Sting. And I don't disagree with either of them. Yeah. But like, right, the name Jimmy Jacobs was just, it was meant to be unassuming. Like, that isn't the right brand for the identity that I had. And so, yeah, I wish in 2005, but it's hard. You're making a name for yourself. And like, but people know this name.
Yeah.
To then go, you know what, F it. I'm going to just make the leap, do what's better for me in the long run and do what I know is right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and when you really dove in and started wrestling full time, one of the places early on you worked regularly for was IWA Mid-South, right, in Southern Indiana. And I know, right, I've heard you, everybody here, so I've gone to tons of IWA Mid-South shows. In Rotten is sometimes a divisive personality, but IWA Mid-South was the promotion at that time in the Midwest. That had to be an extraordinary place for you to really gain experience as you're evolving into a full-time wrestler.
Absolutely. You know, Ian Rotten gave me my first break that like had a somewhat of an international stage for sure. Because those tapes that were distributed through Smart Mark Video were picked up all around the world. I mean, the first time I was flown anywhere was to wrestle Claudio Castagnoli in Germany when I was 19 years old, and the German fans knew me from IW Mid-South, right?
Yeah.
So exposure wise, it was a big deal, even though the live events, some of those weeks, it's like, oh, there's 40 people here.
Yeah.
And yet it was one of the most, the places to work, when, especially when you're coming up and if you want notoriety. Ian was great, partly because he gave opportunity to everybody.
Yeah.
He gave me and Alex Shelley opportunities, and Ian was also the first person to kind of like see something in me to go, you know, I have a match with Ian from April of 2003. And afterwards he gets on the microphone and puts me over and sort of pegs me as going like, hey, one day they're going to talk about you like they talk about, you know, Chris Hero and Colt Cabana and CM Punk, who were kind of like the guys that had really broke out from being an IW Mid-South. And yeah. To some extent, he was right. I wouldn't put myself exactly on the level of those guys, but he saw it very early on. And I'll always have an appreciation for Ian for that and for many things. You know, there's also, I mean, you know, there's Bull Payne there and Michael Todd Stratton and these sort of guys that, you know, I've been at AWA or the Memphis Territory. And so finally I'm around guys like that, because in Michigan, there weren't really guys that really like worked any of the territories too much. It was a bit of a, like the blind leading the blind. And most of the places I worked, it was like that too. So this is the first time I'm like around people who've like been on TV, right? Yeah. Things like that. And I did Mid-South, you know, it was not too long ago in the last few months, I was going back and watching some old IWA stuff of mine. And I appreciate so much that there were no real boundaries at IWA.
Yeah.
You know, like, look, you got to learn to work within the boundaries at some point. Don't get me wrong. But to have that open of a canvas to learn to paint on was invaluable. Yeah. It was invaluable to be able to kind of just, you know, time. It's like, yo, Chris Hero wouldn't even come out in his song until 2 minutes in, right?
Yeah.
Like things like that. Like time just didn't exist. Like you could take it as much time as you want. It wasn't until I got to WWE that I learned the value of a minute.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it was just an amazing place to really start to sink my teeth into something and have the support from guys that knew what they were doing to blossom into the performer and talent that I ended up being, to whatever extent I ended up being talented or a performer.
Yeah. And it's weird. Cause like me being a fan in the Midwest at that time, or, you know, in that era, I mean, I appreciated it then, but not as much as I do now, because looking back, the Midwest was it at that time, in my opinion, right? There's a whole thing on the East Coast that, you know, was happening that, you know, around that time too. But in the Midwest, we were seeing guys like, you know, like you mentioned, Punk, Cabana, Hero, Tyler Black, which, you know, the future Seth Rollins, all these guys coming through, you included. What was it like, though, to be, because I was seeing it as a fan and was loving it, but what was it like for you being part of that? I mean, because there had to be this unbelievable energy, right? Because these guys were all driven.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I was driven, like, this is all I want to do. You know, this is it. This is all I wanted to do. I would take any booking, anytime, any place, anywhere for any amount of money for years. You know, when I graduated high school, you know, I'm 18 and I have a car. And so once that wasn't a thing where I'm like, oh, I've got to go to school, go to high school. Once that was no longer a thing, I was an insane person. There weren't many people more insane than I was. You can go, maybe like, you know, Michael Elgin, he was pretty insane. And by insane, I mean, he wanted the opportunity. He would drive from Toronto to Minnesota for some show, just because he was doing it. Right. Yeah. There's very few people I'll go, yo, you're as insane as me. Like, I'm driving 9 hours to Herrin, Illinois, and then resting in the main event there, leaving there at 2 a.m., driving 16 hours to Asbury Park, New Jersey, to get there just in time for the Ring of Honor show, to wrestle there, and then leave there and go to Cleveland, drive through the night, crash at M Dog's house for a little bit to wrestle in Cleveland the next day, and then drive home, have Monday off, and then drive to the West Virginia on Tuesday. Like, that's a real loop I did. And that's like, if I could possibly make it, I would. So, which is to say, the passion was just there for me. And it was good to be around other people that shared a similar sort of passion. Although I don't know if I was around someone who was as, again, maybe Elgin, but like Alex Shelley wasn't as crazy as me. Yeah. Like, Alex Shelley, you know, we both wanted it, but I would, you know, he within a year of being an IWA Mid-South, started to become a little more, picky about the shows he was going to take and what he was going to do. Me, it was like whatever show, anytime, any place, anywhere. And in the Midwest, there was a lot of work. And it was, like you said, the East Coast was considered the hot thing for you know, when I broke in 99, right? Things were kind of happening East Coast that the After Mags would cover. Glenn Osborne and Ace Darling and CWA, things like that.
Yeah.
And as the advent of the internet sort of starts to show up, you start to get the first crew of guys that are going, you know, fuck just being here or there. Let's go everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I watched what CM Punk and Colt Cabana did, basically. Yeah. The two of them in the car, and they were like, yo, we're going to be on a show in Philly on Friday, Pittsburgh on Saturday, and Chicago Sunday, and then Louisville on Thursday. And then, like, we're going to do it all over again, and we're going to be everywhere. It's like, right, this is how you do it. You go and you wrestle as much as you can, get as many fans as you can, hone your craft to the best of your abilities. Like, this is what you do. And so that was the blueprint that was sort of laid out for me at the time, and that's what we did.
Yeah. And again, it's so I'm also just as passionate a music fan as I am a wrestling fan, and it reminds me so much of some of that early to mid 80s the punk stuff. I love punk, right? And I always go back to that, right? Is, you know, you have Black Flag piling a van, just going out booking their own shows, not caring how many people's there, just, hey, we just, as long as we're playing and just doing it, right? Just wherever they can play. And it's that same mentality, right? Just go out there, perform, wrestle, get that time in the ring. And it's a weird thing is, guys now, because a lot of people, right? I don't want to say a lot, but a lot of people do that now. But back then, it was different, right? That wasn't the norm.
It was, again, with the advent of the internet, I think that really started, you know, it made the world a bit smaller, right?
Yeah, it's like,
oh, look at what they're doing over there. Let's see if we can go over there, too. And in my experience, like, look, when I broke in, I didn't think I was going to go, you know, to WWE or be successful or anything like that. That wasn't the game I was playing. I wasn't playing the game of, like, how do I get to WWE? That wasn't the game. The game was, how do I be a professional wrestler as much as possible? That was the game I was playing. Yep. And it turned out that by playing that game of all I want to do is be a pro wrestler, let me just do this and keep doing it because I just want to do it. That is what led to the subsequent, whatever amount of success I did have, is a consequence of that. It wasn't until I was in a WWE ring at the age of 21 that I was like, oh, so I could be in WWE then. This could happen. Like, that's possible. That's part of reality now. It's no longer a pipe dream. I'm in a WWE ring. Oh, right. If I keep going down the road I'm going, like, yeah, this could definitely happen.
Yeah. Well, when most people, right, when they think Jimmy Jacobs, right, they think Ring of Honor. It's almost synonymous. And you started with ROH around 2003. And again, at that time, right, you're, like you said, you're working wherever, right? You're just driving all over, taking bookings. But how did the connection make, how did that connection get made with you and Ring of Honor just to start working for them?
Yeah, so I've known CM Punk since I was 16 years old, and Punk was not kind to me when we first met. He thought I was an idiot, and you know, to some extent, he was probably right. He was a bully. Yeah. So he saw a vulnerable, kind of idiotic 16-year-old kid, and he was a bully to me for the first couple years I knew him. Mm-hmm. But when I was like 18, 19, and he saw that I wasn't just a fucking idiot. I was an idiot that wanted nothing more than to be a pro wrestler. And I was honing my craft and putting in the work that it took to become a competent performer. He started to take a liking to me and Alex Shelley too. Mm-hmm. So we were doing a feud in me and Alex Shelley in IW Mid-South, and Punk, you know, Punk used to be at most of those shows, or at least the big ones. And he would do commentary on the matches sometimes. And so he had seen enough of me and Shelley's work, and he asked me to give him a tape to give to Gabe Sapolsky, who's the booker of Ring of Honor at the time. And he did. And Gabe came back and said, they're good, but they're not Ring of Honor good. Fair enough. But quite shortly thereafter, Ring of Honor wanted to book Chris Sabin in Philadelphia. And my guess, and this is just a guess, is that they didn't want to fly him, pay for a flight. So they said, Gabe told Sabin, bring a couple guys and I'll put them on the pre-show. And so because Shelley and I were out there just doing it like we were doing it, Sabin came to us and he said, hey, do you guys want to, you know, be on an ROH pre-show? And of course we do, you know, drive out to Philadelphia for $50 and no trans to be on ROH. So absolutely. And so he told Gabe Sapolsky, he's like, yeah, I got Jimmy Jacobs and Alex Shelley. And Gabe said, oh, I just saw their stuff. They're actually pretty good. We'll put them on the main show. And so our first show was in Philadelphia in June of 03. It was a four-way with me, Alex Shelley, BJ Whitmer, and Tony Mamaluke. And yeah, it went well. It went well. You know, again, I got paid $50. We didn't get trans. We drove from Detroit to Philadelphia and back. Just like, you know, it's not, you didn't get a hotel. You're not making that sort of money. It was great. It felt like
You're on top of the road, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
At 19 years old, dude, we leave the Murphy Rec Center and there's like fans outside waiting for us. There's these girls that give me and Alex Shelley roses. And we're like, this is it. We made it to the big times.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because when you think of Ring, right? I mean, obviously, first thing that pops in mind when I think Ring of Honor is the Briscoe brothers. But you were there so much through so many of the changes and the different incarnations over the years. And that included, right, you were the ownership change to Kerry Silken.
Yep.
What was that like at that time for the guy? Because, again, I know there was a lot of controversy before, you know, pre-Kerry Silken. But I love Kerry. I've talked to Kerry many times. He's a great guy. But what was that like for the guys there when Kerry came on board as the new ownership for Ring of Honor?
So Kerry was around before he fully owned the company. So he was, I believe, investing prior to that. And then it was April, I think, of 04. I think that's right. April of 04. When the stuff with Rob Feinstein came out.
Yeah.
And I remember where I was when Gabe Sapolsky called me and just sort of gave me a rundown, like, hey, Rob's out. You know, that was going on. And it was business as usual. And that's really a, I mean, I remember it being, you know, a bit like weird or uncertain at the time. Like, yo, is this a big deal? Because this feels like it might be a big deal here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm glad that things sorted out the way they sorted out.
Yeah, because Kerry wound up being a great guy for Ring of Honor, right? He's
the man. Kerry's the man.
Yeah, he is. He's talked about, you know, how much he's that he lost money. He didn't care, right? He was there. He was in, you know, and again, whatever. Kerry was. I always call him, you know, whatever time I talk about, call him Mr. ROH because I thought he's the guy. And but so anyway, though, going back with you in Ring of Honor, one of the most memorable angles that you were involved with was the Age of the Fall. And leading up to that debut, there was the messages on the ROH website, the blog, under the name Project 161. Tell me, and again, you may have said this, maybe I've missed it. What's Project 161? How did that name, that little bit come about?
Well, the 161 refers to the show number for ROH. Where we debuted at the Man Up pay-per-view in Chicago was the 161st show.
Gotcha. Okay.
Ring of Honor. So that's where that's from. Although in the midst of our viral marketing campaign, someone did notice that if you exchange the numbers for letters in 161, it spells out the name Afa. So perhaps Afa of the Wild Samoans might be behind this. Who knows?
Could be, right? Yeah.
Right. So that was the viral marketing campaign, which was Gabe's idea. He had seen it through Nine Inch Nails, had started to do this sort of stuff where they're, you know, leaving USB drives in a bathroom at their shows. And then the fan shares that on the internet. Da, da, da. So we were doing our best to sort of do stuff like that, have stuff written on the bathroom mirrors at the shows. Have a, you know, a guy walk around with a sign that just says, you know, Project 161 and the whatever cryptic videos that are released. And then the video has a thing in it too, that leads you somewhere. So yeah, it was an interesting thing to be a part of.
Yeah. And it was very advanced, right? Cause again, I mean, even talking about the term blog, which is almost an outdated term anymore. It's funny. If you weren't there, the internet then wasn't what it is now. Right. It wasn't like every single person had it in their pocket per se. It was a little different. Right. And it was, so this was to me very advanced. Right. It was thinking very forward thinking. And you said Gabe was by, but was this whole Age of the Fall, the entire concept, was that a Gabe thing or?
Yeah, more or less. Like, well, I mean, everything's collaborative, right? It's hard to ever go, this is me, this is him. It was his idea to have me lead basically a band of misfits. So probably his initial conception was probably closer to something to Raven's Flock than what the Age of the Fall ended up being. And so he and I collaborated on who would be in it. I had pitched Tyler Black, and his tag team partner, Tyler Black and his tag team partner, Merrick Brave.
There you go.
I had pitched them. Gabe brought them down to Florida to FIP to take a look at them. And he basically said, Merrick's not ready. Tyler's the guy. He's going to be a star. And so we both agreed on that. And we agreed on Necro Butcher and Lacey. And with Tyler, and Tyler had Tyler's a couple years younger than me, but I don't know, man, at 21 and 23, 2 years is much bigger than 40 and 42.
Right. So, yeah.
So he was a little more like tuned in, a little more on the scene. And he had some ideas that I think gave the Age of the Fall a lot of its shape. Tyler from Tyler Black is taken from Tyler Durden from Fight Club.
Yeah.
And so Project 161 is a bit of a nod to Fight Club, Project Mayhem or Project whatever they have there. And then the group goes from being like just kind of social misfits to sort of social revolutionaries, a little more like that, a little, a little more.
Yeah. Well, when you guys debut, right, you're talking, like you mentioned, you, Necro, Tyler, you attack the Briscoes, right? Again, the Briscoes, right? That's synonymous with Ring of Honor. And you hung Jay upside down. His blood was dripping on you as you're cutting this promo. But at the time, this was all deemed so controversial that Ring of Honor cut it from the pay-per-view footage, blah, 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 for a while. What did you think in that moment? Were you irritated that this got cut, or were you like, yes, we've done so much that it has pushed it to this limit.
So I didn't think either of those.
Okay.
So I thought what we did, it was initially like, it was awesome. It was like, it's a great visual, right?
Sure.
But pretty much almost as soon as it happened, I was like, hold, like, it's a really funny thing because it's a angle probably I'm best known for, like, the yep. best known angle I did, maybe the Battle of Lacey, but the Hanging Jay Briscoe. And it's also a thing that like makes me cringe because it was very shortly after, I was like, why did I cut a 5-minute promo underneath it? Like, no one cared. I could have just stood there. Why was I talking? In my mind, we had built up this, you know, Project 161, and we needed this big payoff, and people needed this explanation. They needed to know all of it. Now I look back and go, why did I talk at all? I could have said one line and walked away. So in my mind, when they didn't put it on the pay-per-view, I kind of, you know, they said it was too controversial. I kind of thought, or maybe they clipped it because it sucked, because it didn't work that I talked for 5 minutes. Like, that wasn't the right segment. And I don't know the truth. You know, if I just stood there and like you go off the pay-per-view with me just going, the Project 161 is over, the Age of the Fall has just begun. Like, does that make the show? I don't know.
Yeah.
Was it pretty sick? You know, Gabe, I never thought it pushed the line too much. But Gabe, that is a handful of years ago now, told me that it was one of the things that he would never do again. Like, if given the opportunity, he wouldn't have done that again.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? It was that? You know, I just thought it was a great visual. I thought it was a great visual. So I didn't understand exactly what was so controversial about it, if that makes sense. I know it was sick, but it felt the appropriate amount of sickness for pro wrestling.
Sure. Definitely. You know what I
mean? It pushes it, but it's not like, oh, this is, oh, having a guy bleed. And, you know, it's like, yeah, we do that all the time. I'm just wearing white and he's just hanging there. Is that much different? It feels like an appropriate pro wrestling angle to me.
Yeah. Are you that kind of performer? You mentioned that you look back and thought, why did I cut a 5-minute promo? Are you that kind of guy that a lot of times reflects back on things and thinks, why did I do that? Why, or I could have done that different with hindsight and experience. Now, I'm not saying be critical, but do you kind of reflect on some of the things in your career like that sometimes?
Of course. I mean, you're constantly cleaning up your game. I mean, in wrestling or in life or whatever. If you're not examining the fruits of your actions, then I don't know what you're doing with your life. And certainly that was a big learning lesson. That was a big lesson for me. You know, this big angle, this big thing, they're about to get behind me and going, oh, look, I missed. Yeah. Like I went for a home run, and thankfully, because the visual, like, it's a strong, you know, get to third base. If you're a sports guy, I'm not. Mm. So I'm making this up as I go along. So, you know, it gets us talking about it 20 years later. But it wasn't as a professional, as someone that takes pride in their work, that wants to feel good about what they're doing, it was a miss to me.
Yeah. Right. It wasn't the promo. It was the visual, right? I gotcha. And again, that's right. That I think that's what, no matter what you do, right. Like you mentioned, you should do that, right? Cause you should strive to improve. You should strive to reflect upon yourself and find your faults and, you know, learn to improve on that, because that's what makes you better.
That's right.
Yeah. And in 2009, you left Ring of Honor. Why was it? Was there any big reason why at that time?
So Gabe had left. He got fired in October of 2008. Adam Pearce had come on to be Booker. And I love Adam. I do. It's hard to transition someone else's stories and someone else's characters, someone else's sort of mind. It's hard to, like, you gotta clean up the old Booker's stuff. You gotta like wrap that up, and then you kind of got to get into to your stuff. Sure. And so I say that to say, like, Gabe was probably more tuned in and had a vision more for me and my character than Adam did. And that's, again, that's not being like critical of Adam as a Booker, performer, mind, sure, person, anything like that. It's just sort of matter of fact. Like he's now, like, Gabe's gone and now he's left like, all right, what are we going to do? Whereas Gabe had plans. Gabe had a, you know, the whole thing. So, and I'm not going to say that's the reason, because it's not, but sort of a bit of the fallout from that. And again, the characters, the Age of the Fall had kind of had its run. Sure. Anyway.
Yeah.
We main evented basically for a year from, you know, September of 1 year to September of the next year. We were Nigel was the world champion, and, yep, you know, we were tag team champions often, and I was highlighted in a singles role sometimes in the main event. So we're like in the main event. I was in the main event scene for like a year, and then we built up heat, and then we were at the point where, you know, we were popping the balloon. You know, you put the baby faces over. It's like, here, you know, Steen and Generico. You give them the tag titles in like August in Boston, and then we do some sort of cage thing in September with the Briscoes and, you know, Aries and whomever, and, you know, I think they beat us. And I think Necro had turned by that point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I challenged Nigel for the title in Japan, and I lose. So it's like, whatever heat we built up, it's now, after a year, it had been time to pop the balloon anyway. So yeah, what we had coming out of that is a story with me and Seth. And I was just sort of, I was featured well. So I'm not like, disparaging how Adam featured me at all, only that it seemed like the time for the story was kind of wrapping up.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, and without Gabe's vision for its future, Adam and I together didn't quite bring it to life like Gabe and I had brought it together, to whatever degree it did come to life.
Yeah.
By the time I, you know, some of these shows, fuck. I remember the months leading up to I left in June of 2009, there were some shows where I was getting like no reaction. Like I was, yeah, I was dead in the water.
Yeah.
And I saw it. So I see that like whatever we're doing isn't working, and the story's coming to an end. The Age of the Fall is coming to an end. Tyler's a baby face now. We do our feud, which was like okay, but not great. And it was just kind of like, yeah, this is complete right now, and I need to go away. And the plan was for me to leave for like maybe 3 months, and 3 months turned into 2 years.
Yeah. I'm right. There's that old adage all the way back to the territorial days, right? To be missed, you have to go away, right? You have to freshen up, whatever else. That's part of it, right? You can't. It's hard not to get stale when you're there all the time.
I think so. I mean, you have to be like, this is part of why I consider John Cena the greatest of all time, is really the frequency in which he was on television, mm-hmm, and always stayed interesting. Like, sure, that is a feat, man. That is a feat to go out there every single week, have the fans see you for years, and still to be able to get the reactions that John did. That's part of why I consider him the greatest of all time.
Yeah.
You know, the flip side of, you know, what you're pointing out is that you got to freshen yourself up, is you don't know what's going to happen if you take yourself off the board.
Right. Yeah.
And again, what happened with me is I took myself off the board, and it was like, it's 3 months later, it's 4 months later, it's 6 months later. It's like, oh, okay. Right. And it needed to wait 2 years to come back, which I don't regret. I'm not saying I regret it. I'm saying that's part of it. Part of it is if you take the risk of taking yourself off the board without being, mm-hmm, sufficiently over, it's not clear when, you know, a lot of people are vying for those spots.
Sure. Yeah. And that, again, that's right. That's the old adage in wrestling, right? Everybody's competing for spots. that's why these guys, why so many guys work injured and this and that. You don't want to give up your spot because of that fear of losing it. And like you mentioned, you returned to Ring of Honor around 2011. This was also around the time of the Sinclair Broadcasting purchase. Are those two events related at all?
I don't know how related they are. So yes. So the day I returned is actually the day that Sinclair announced they purchased the company. Okay. I was not aware of that going into it. Now, was I called back and was, you know, was Kevin out at that point? Kevin was out at that point too. So were Kevin and I called back because, you know, these, now we're going to be on television with Sinclair. Mm-hmm. Maybe that might've been an impetus for Delirious, for the Booker to, you know, for this idea, for the story. But I don't know.
Yeah. You mentioned Delirious. Everybody that I get the opportunity to talk about Delirious. How underappreciated is Delirious as a wrestling mind?
He's low key. Like he booked Ring of Honor for like 10 years, from 2010, 2011 to 2021 or whatever it is, for like 10 years.
I know. Unreal.
That's amazing.
It is.
That really takes a lot because the job of Booker is almost like by definition underappreciated. It's like, it's your job to take all the blame. And when shit's good, it's the boys.
Yep.
So, and yo, as a performer, Delirious was a genius performer.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't use that word lightly. I like watch his stuff from like, watch the trilogy of basically comedy matches he had with CM Punk in IW Mid-South. Like, he's a genius.
Yeah.
He's a genius. Like, the character of not talking, but talking gibberish.
Yeah.
Sometimes some English words slip in, but even when he's talking gibberish, you kind of get what he's saying because he knows how to emote and present his body and his fucking and project so well. And the depth of his character, like what it's scared of, what it likes, how it'll get confused by this, but not by that. His body language as a storyteller, it's genius, man.
Yeah.
I was watching some a few months ago and I texted him like, dude, I was always a fan of his work, but I'm like, now at 42 years old, I look at it and go, this was genius.
Yeah.
This is like, there's nobody else like this. Nobody yeah. else has done this. And I don't know how many people could even pull it off, and Delirious pulled it off, but like once in a lifetime, man.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and again, when you return, right, you did the whole thing where you tried to purge yourself of evil. And eventually it led to you turning heel and forming a stable with Kevin Steen, Steve Corino, called Scum. And this is outside of the Age of the Fall, probably the second thing you're probably most known for, at least in my eyes. Do you have a preference, though, on the build-up to the reveal of the Age of the Fall or the build-up to the reveal of Scum?
I mean, I was much more personally invested in the Age of the Fall.
Gotcha.
than Scum for a couple of reasons. One, I mean, they're kind of the same reason. They're a bit of similar reasons. Age of the Fall was a conception of, you know, me and Gabe Sapolsky and Tyler Black, right? It was, mm-hmm. So I had my creative hands in there pretty deeply. Scum was not. I didn't have my creative hands in Scum almost at all. Kevin is a pretty strong creative force. And he's got great instincts and he's mostly right and all this stuff. So it's like, I have no problem like acquiescing, which meaning like I just had a different role. Like yeah. I was a leader in Age of the Fall, both in front of the scenes and behind the scenes. With Scum, like I wasn't. Again, Kevin was more creatively the driving force insofar as any of us were. And this was when Sinclair had the company too. And so when Sinclair owned the company, like I didn't like working for Sinclair Broadcasting Group. I didn't like their office. I didn't like the office. I didn't like how they treated me. I didn't deem them as, I didn't like them. So, yeah. I wasn't like collaborating like I was previously. So Scum is cool to me because I got to be with Kevin and Steve, who I love, and Kevin's one of my best friends, and that was our time together.
Yeah,
that's what Scum was to me, like the time for the three of us together, who legitimately, in some sense, and granted, they put the world title on Kevin, they put the tag titles on me and Steve.
Yeah.
But in some sort of legitimate way, like we weren't the chosen. You know what I mean? Like we weren't the guys that they, you know, Jim Cornette wasn't particularly a fan of Kevin Steen. Like,
yeah, he makes that clear.
Yeah. Right. I'm not speaking out of turn. He said no. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. All the time.
And you know, when Steve and I won the tag titles, it was when Kenny King was tag champions, and his ROH contract lapsed and he just went to TNA.
Yeah.
So they vacated the tag titles and it was like, all right, who are we going to put them on? Oh, put them on Steve and Jimmy over there. So there was something of like, yeah, we aren't really the guys. We aren't the chosen ones here, but we're holding the fort down nonetheless. And I think there's a certain camaraderie in that.
Yeah. You brought up Cornette. I was actually going to ask you, right? Cornette's obviously a very polarizing figure in wrestling. He's very opinionated, and he worked with Ring of Honor from 2009 to 2012. Again, Cornette's been very vocal. He was not a fan of Steen. He butted heads with Steen. Did you and Cornette ever have any problems? No.
I always liked Jim. I think he liked me enough. You know, like I'm not like his guy. You know, he doesn't look at me and go, hey, let's invest in 5'7", out of shape, 150-pound Jimmy Jacobs. Like, Jim's not thinking that.
Yeah.
But Jim was always cool to me. He was always helpful to me. I liked having Jim around. He's got an amazing mind. It's always worth hearing what Jim Cornette has to say when he's being serious about what he's saying. And even if I don't agree with it, like it's always worth hearing what he has to say.
Right.
And what he, you know, yeah. So I like Jim quite a bit.
Yeah.
But like I wasn't his guy and he's not my guy. We work together and I like Jim.
Yeah. I often, again, I was an avid watcher of Ring of Honor. Right. And I always felt as a fan that Ring of Honor was kind of a spiritual successor to ECW. That it was almost, I always thought that it was very much what ECW might have evolved into had it continued on. Something similar to what Ring of Honor was, right? No, you know, not as, you know, no frills, a little more competitive, a little more aggressive. Maybe it was, you know, like I've mentioned before, maybe it was that punk rock DIY attitude. What do you think of that? Were you a fan of Ring of Honor, or excuse me, of ECW? Did you feel that maybe with ECW being gone, that Ring of Honor was kind of taking up that mantle a little bit?
Well, yes, I was a fan of ECW because ECW was freaking awesome. It was awesome. Definitely. You know, like at a certain point when I was a wrestler, like, you know, when you're in the business, brother, you know, you can look at that stuff. You go, oh, look, these guys don't look, they're not doing this right. They don't know what they're doing here. And this isn't whatever. You get in that era of your life, which is basically being a smart mark. And no, now I look at it. It's amazing. It's amazing. ECW was amazing. ROH in some sense did pick up the mantle because that's how it came about. Right.
Sure. Of course. Yes.
RF had, you know, been successful selling ECW tapes and they wanted something that fills that gap. And so they created Ring of Honor. The interesting thing about Ring of Honor in relationship to ECW though, to me is I don't agree that Ring of Honor is what ECW might have grown into. Because what was happening with, you know, ECW and the fallout from that is ECW is like extreme, right? It's hardcore.
Sure.
And so the sort of children of ECW are like CZW, XPW. Like everybody's trying to do, well, let's make it more extreme. Let's make it more violent. Let's, throw this guy off this high of scaffolding and let's do the weed whackers and this barbed wire. And the brilliance about ROH was going, okay, we see we're kind of at the end of that road. There's only so far that road goes down, and we're reaching kind of the end of it. How much more can you do in glass and whatever? You go, so what if we go the exact opposite end of things? Now it's heat if you don't shake someone's hand. That's now right. People are going to cheer for this cool hammerlock reversal. We're going to make them go, oh, look, competitive wrestling. Just, oh, and so it is, there is the spirit of ECW in there, but taking to the other side of the other extreme, basically going from being extreme to going, all right, now everybody gets along. Now everybody shakes hands, and our heel is the guy that doesn't shake someone's hand. Like, imagine that story, you know, in ECW. It's like, no, you got to blast him with a chair, and you got to do this for heat, and you got to crucify him for heat, and you got to do this for heat. It's like, yeah, this guy's just not going to shake people's hands for a while.
Yeah.
We'll keep that story going on for a while where everybody shakes hands, but Christopher Daniels.
Which worked. I mean,
right.
Right. It absolutely worked for him.
Because you're setting the rules. You're setting you're making the universe. It's making universe, right?
Sure.
You create the rules for that universe and, you know, condition the fans / get a sort of contract of suspension of disbelief from the fans based on the confines, the rules, the structure that you give them. And so they just put the structure at something completely different, and it worked.
Yeah. I mean, we have this code of honor. Everybody abides by it, but this one guy refuses to. Right. Well, what's wrong with this asshole? It's right. You have set the boundaries, and yeah, I mean, and again, right. It was like setting those, reshocking the system.
Yes. And that's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing. It's a hard thing to do. You know, sometimes people lament about, oh, wrestling's so different than it used to be, and I wish we could just have job matches, and why are they kicking out of these moves? That used to be a finisher. It's like, yo, this is the evolution of things. Like, there's no stopping it, and there's no going back. Like, you have to do something different. Like, when the world changes, like, it's like you have to do something different. You can't go backwards in the world.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist anymore. The cat's out of the bag. Especially again with the information era, with the internet, it's like people are attuned to something else now. That's not what they're attuned to anymore. That'll be boring if you do that. They're too desensitized, because you have to keep like turning the knobs up on different things to alter it, right? You have to keep turning the knobs up. We've seen this, we've seen this, we've seen this. So you have a norm, and then you keep sort of pushing the norm, and it's fair enough. That's how it goes. You keep pushing the norm to keep drawing attention, because that's what you're doing. But once you push the norm far enough in one direction, there's a new normal.
Yep.
And the new normal is this. And you can't actively fully go back to the old normal, because that's gone now. That doesn't exist.
Yeah. I had family members when I was a kid watching wrestling that would literally say that the same things people say nowadays, right? Oh, this is so fake. This is when I watched wrestling, it was real. It was this. It was the same concept, right? It's everybody thinks the next generation's killing the business, and it is what it is, right?
And I'm here at 42 years old now going, you guys are killing the business. This isn't the business I was in.
I know it. But that's the thing, right? I mean, at my age, it's like, if I don't like it, it's like, I just don't watch it, right? I just watch the stuff I like. I go back and watch tapes and whatever. I let them do their thing. I don't care. And but let's talk briefly about the WWE, right? You were hired in 2015 as a writer or part of the creative team, whatever you want to call it. So who reached out to you about that position? How did that come about?
That came about, I reached out to Brian Danielson about it. I had a bit of an epiphany, and I was like, what am I doing? I'm banging my head up against the wall, you know, for 16 years as a wrestler, as a performer. And the last, you know, I mean, really, I would say I was most highly featured in the Age of the Fall from 2007 to 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you could say the scum run, you know, 2012, 2013 was also highly featured role. But, you know, the trajectory I had, you know, starting at, you know, 19 doing the Bruiser Brody stuff, then, you know, 21, you know, I'm IWA Mid-South champion, I'm the Ring of Honor tag team champions, and then 2002 doing the Battle of Lacey and being on MTV, and then the Age of the Fall, like that trajectory peaked. Like, you know, I wasn't going up anymore. I was muddling in the middle, not really finding my footing as like, okay, I'm not a top level performer. I'm not a super in-demand talent. I'm eking by as a struggling artist of an independent wrestler. And I go, what am I doing? I'm supposed to be in creative at WWE. I learned to tell stories with myself so I could tell stories for other people. That's what I'm here for. And so I called Brian Danielson, and eventually what happened was, Brian's the man. WWE in December of 14 was doing a 3-day run. It was like Cleveland, Detroit, Cleveland for a pay-per-view, then Detroit for Raw, maybe Grand Rapids for SmackDown. And I called Tyler Black, asked him to book me as an extra, or get me booked as an extra, which he did. Thank you. Thank you, Seth. And then I called Brian Danielson. I called Joey Mercury and I said, hey guys, I'm booked for these shows as an extra, but I'm not coming there to get a job as a wrestler. I'm coming there to get a job as a writer. Like, help me, put me in front of the people I need to be in front of. And in Cleveland, Brian and Joey brought me to Dave Kapoor, Ranjan Singh, who was managing the creative team. And Brian said, this is Jimmy Jacobs. He's a genius and he belongs on your team. And that was sort of the start of it. That opened the door enough for me to, you know, have the interview and do the writing sample and all that sort of stuff. So I got the call that they were hiring me in beginning of March of 15. So it was about beginning of December to beginning of March, about a 4-month process. Mm-hmm. And then I started in the beginning of April. So about a 5-month process from the day that I was introduced to Dave Kapoor to when I started.
Yeah. And you had a little rub it. If you don't mind, tell us about the famous picture in 2017, right? Tell us about this incident.
Yeah. So we were doing Raw in Ontario, California. And, yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Yep. Okay. Yep. I can hear you. So, okay. Yeah, we were doing a Raw in Ontario, California, and I got a text actually from Kevin. Kevin texted me and he goes, hey, are the Young Bucks at Raw? I go, I don't think so. And he goes, yeah, I think they're outside the arena. And I go, let me check. And then I go out there and I see the Young Bucks and Adam Page and Marty Scurll and Cody Rhodes. And I was happy to see him. I was like, oh, what are you guys doing here? And they're shooting their thing. And right before I left, he's like, yo, let's take a picture together. And I wasn't planning on putting it up. And then it was during, I want to say like seg 4 of Raw. I was in gorilla position. And I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to fucking post this. And I posted it. And a half hour later, I'm getting pulled into the writer's room going for my boss going, why the hell am I seeing this here? What is this? And I'm like, oh, you know. He's like, oh, Triple H is not happy about this. And so, all right, yeah. And so I go to Triple H's office and Hunter and I talked for a while about it. And he seemed cool enough about it. You know, he wasn't happy as we talked. His frustration with me seemed to dwindle. And then I went, so we had SmackDown the next day. And then I flew right from there to Italy for just a family vacation. And I flew right from Italy to Denver the next week for Raw and SmackDown. And then Thursday rolls around and this is my first day in the office since the incident. So I just say to myself, I was like, all right, if I make it through today, it'll be fine. If I don't make it through today, then I'll make it through today. And first thing in the morning, the administrative assistant's like, could you go see Dave Kapoor at the HR office and on floor 3? I'm like, all right, well, this is it. This is the day I'm getting fired by WWE. What a day, which I was fine with. I felt some resentment towards Vince of how Vince treated me because he was a bully, and he is a bully. He's a bully, and he's a psychopath and a narcissist. Yeah, almost certainly a narcissist, but definitely he's a psychopath.
He's a, you know, no doubt.
That's technically the name. Yeah. And I'm not saying that like hyperbolically. I'm saying there are certain people on, you know, there's certain human beings that derive their, let's say, their energy from sucking it from other people that are predators. Like Vince is a predator. He's, you know, and of course, whatever's come out with him has come out with him. But in the company, he liked to mess with people. And, you know, he messed with me like he messed with other people. Yep. And at the time, you're like, well, it's his sandbox. He can do whatever he wants. You're just playing in it. And so I did leave with a little resentment towards how I was treated by Vince. But mostly I left with relief. Mostly, yeah. Like the day I got fired, it was like, oh, it's over. Good. You know, the last 6 months I was there, I was not happy. I'd gotten out of rehab at the end of May of 2017. And being at that job now without the armor of drugs, numbing, masking the stress of the job and the stress of just being treated like a fucking piece of shit by your boss. I didn't like it. I started to really not like it. I really didn't like it. So what actually happened is I acted out like a child. That's what happened. I acted out like a child. I took this picture that I knew they wouldn't like. I didn't do this consciously. This is all unconscious, right?
Sure.
I was too scared to go to my boss and go, hey, I'm not happy right now. Like, I didn't, you know, I worked my whole life to get here. Like, what am I going to do? I have no ground to stand on. I have no place to go, hey, treat me better. You know, if I could go back, I would have, you know, been like, hey, can you send me down to Florida? Let me work at a performance center. Let me do something else. Let me get away from the stuff that I don't like.
Yeah.
I wish I had done that. I wish I had just been communicative, but I wasn't at that place in my life. So instead I acted out like a child and, you know, wanted to see what happened. I was sick of just being in this box, this make believe corporate box of, you know, how Vince thought everybody around him should act, which would change moment to moment too. It's like, I was sick of it. It was like, look, fuck you guys. This is me. You want me or not? No, good. That's what happened. Is like, I acted out because I wasn't happy there. And when they fired me, I was relieved. And if they hadn't fired me, then at least they would have seen, yo, this is what you got. You don't have a perfectly corporate, just, yeah, I'll be like this. I'll bow down to this. I'm like, nah, man, like, yo, I'm doing my thing, whatever. And if you don't like my thing, that's fine. And it is fine. I mean that when I say it's fine, I mean that. I mean that, like, WWE wasn't a good, working for Vince McMahon was ultimately not a good fit for me or for Vince. I loved my time there. I cherished it. I'm so glad I learned so much. It changed my life. There's so many great things I learned there. Being hired by WWE was an amazing gift, and getting fired from WWE was an amazing gift too.
Yeah. And coming out of WWE, right? You worked the indies a little more. You had a stint through Impact as a member of their creative. But then I really want to talk next about in 2023, you went to AEW as a producer and creative member there also. And this really, if you look at it on paper, right, this seems like a natural fit. Jimmy Jacobs, AEW, this seems like it would work, but you were only there for a little over a year. What was there a reasoning behind that? What happened there?
Yeah, so I was at Impact for 5.5 years, and my initially it was a great change from WWE. I went from Vince micromanaging to Scott D'Amore, who kind of let me do my thing. And if he didn't like it, he would talk to me about it. And then we go, okay, great. Yeah, we won't do it like that again, right? Yeah. So I basically had permission to make mistakes, which you kind of don't have in WWE because you don't know the one weird thing that you do that Vince is going to blow up on you on.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was good for a while. In 2000, I want to say 19, Sanjay Dutt left the creative team. So my responsibilities on the creative team at Impact became a bit different. I started, instead of, you know, just producing segments and writing and producing pre-tapes and that sort of thing, I started like crafting the shows. I was, you know, I was writing the formats. I was responsible for like a different level of the creative process, if that makes sense. Right.
Sure. Yeah.
So there's a bunch of puzzle pieces and you have to put the puzzle pieces together. That's the level I was working at more or less for my time at the end of Impact. Like I'm taking what we come up with and I'm arranging the ideas and making the ideas flow into each other and making sure that nothing steps on anything else. And this is like bigger picture stuff. And then there's the job of like, that I had in WWE is like being on the ground, writing these pre-tapes word for word, you know, producing every little bit of it, getting every fine detail of the piece that I'm coloring. And that piece goes into a big puzzle. So by the time I left Impact, I was creatively, I was creatively dry. That's a fine way. I was creatively constricted. And not happy. I was not happy the last maybe year and a half at Impact. And I wasn't happy in my life either. I had moved to Georgia. I bought a 7-acre property in the middle of nowhere. And I basically found out how hard it was to just be alone. Because I was just alone with myself. I said, fuck the world. I'm going to live. I'm out in the middle of nowhere because fuck all this shit. and then I saw how fucking hard that was. And so I'm personally having a difficult time, professionally having a bit of a difficult time. And so when Brian Danielson comes to me to join AEW as they're introducing the second show of Collision, I thought it sounded like a good idea. I said, all right, so this involved, I moved down to Florida, so it gets me out of this place in Georgia. I moved to Jacksonville. I travel with Tony, and I'm not doing anything creative, really. This is mostly like logistics and administrative sort of stuff on the creative team, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like I'm not coming up with the segments or things that they do. Tony's coming up with the segments or talent or whoever is coming up with the segments. I'm putting it on paper. I'm telling the people who need to know what they need to know. I'm like a middleman of logistics in the creative process. I'm not really a creative mind craft or, you know, coming up with the ideas for the shows.
Yeah.
So that's what I was doing there. And my state, my mental state, my emotional state, the state of my life, the state of me. The travel was a lot. I would fly out Tuesday, do Dynamite Wednesday, fly home Thursday, fly out Friday, do Collision Saturday, fly home Sunday, mm-hmm. be home Monday, right? So Monday's the only day I'm home all week. That was a lot. Despite my abilities, my talents to do it well, the job itself wasn't particularly rewarding because I had gone so far from doing like creative stuff, which is what I liked. Although again, I was creatively constricted is the best way to put it. So ideas weren't coming to me at Impact. So taking this job at AEW where I don't have to come up with any ideas, where I don't have to go, oh my, what are we doing for this story this week? Seemed really refreshing to me, but the truth was it ended up being just like, well, I've just taken out all the fun stuff,
yeah.
really. All the, yeah. like all of the rewarding stuff, the yeah. stuff that yes, sometimes it's hard to come out and you don't know if an idea is going to come out. You don't know if the idea is going to be good, but that process is rewarding. Once you do it, once something comes, you know, goes from your mind to the screen, to the stage, it's rewarding. And so the tasks themselves for me at AEW weren't rewarding tasks. So it wasn't, I thought it was going to be a good fit for me in that way. And it kind of wasn't a good fit for me that way. As a matter of fact, it there wasn't much I felt rewarded doing. I was a cog in a machine, which of course you always are. But just for me, it didn't end up being great like that. That was part of it too. And yeah. part of it was just, dude, it was me. It was me. Like it was 25 years of taking almost every single wrestling show I could possibly be a part of. I was a part of. Yeah. I can count on one or maybe two hands the number of wrestling shows I had opted out of being a part of because of something non-wrestling related, right? I turned down bookings to get another booking, but to go, hey, you want to be a part of this wrestling show, and for me to say no because I'm doing something else, because there's something else I want to be doing, like under 10, man, under 10.
Yeah.
So 25 years of that, 25 years of that, it finally caught up. And it was like, oh, this is, I'm going to break here. Like,
yeah.
Like it's time for me to go. Yeah. And it was a really hard decision. I was making very good money. It was a stable job. You know, Tony was great, got a great heart, good guy. He would have probably kept me on board forever. And to walk away from a sure thing with nothing on the horizon. Yeah, that's scary, man. That's
sure. Scary. Yeah. But well, and of course, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm almost done here. But I had to do it because I had gotten, so when I got fired from WWE, again, I was so scared to ever leave there. And when I got fired, I was like, all right, here we go. And I had a great time. Like a month after I got fired, I was like, yo, I'm having the best time of my life. And it is probably my favorite time in my wrestling career. Like there's like 2 or 3 months after I get fired from WWE. I was having a blast.
Yeah.
And I go, oh, there's nothing to be scared of. I see. It was like the universe gave me that one for free. They gave me a freebie. You know, I got a freebie to go, oh, look, I don't have to be somewhere that isn't for me anymore. And so now here I was, you know, whatever, handful of years later, 7 years later, almost the beginning of October, same time, to go, yeah, so now I have to be the one to make the decision. Because last time it was done for me and it turned out great. And so now I have to be the one to do it. And so it was like a, you know, whatever. It was an exercise in trust. How about that?
Yeah. Well, and of course, Tony Khan now owns Ring of Honor. And as someone who has always been deeply embedded in ROH, what do you think of the current incarnation of Ring of Honor?
The pay-per-views are outstanding. Athena as champion. I mean, she's been, you know, what can compare? Who can compare? Yeah, she's been champion there for 3 years or whatever. And it's like, and like you watch her and it's like, yeah, rightfully so.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the week to week stuff, it does not have the spirit of the old Ring of Honor in it. Right.
Yeah.
Watch, you know, and I get it. Like, Tony loved, you know, he loved like AEW Dark and Elevation to get guys wins, to get guys reps, you know, things like that. And so, you know, when I was there, there was a lot, you know, Ring of Honor have like a lot of job matches on them.
Yeah.
It was, you know, AEW has the spirit of Ring of Honor, not Ring of Honor. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the era we're living in right now is the Ring of Honor era. These are the fruits of what we did 25 years ago, whatever, 24 years ago.
Yeah.
These are the fruits, right? And it's almost, I'd say coming to an end, but you know, you know, Seth's 40 now. So it's like,
yeah,
the guys that came out of Ring of Honor that ended up, you know, really like revolutionizing the wrestling business, Ring of Honor did, you know, mm-hmm. part of why it's, you know, it was brilliant. The choice they made to go from extreme to just sort of this pure wrestling thing, because that, I mean, that's what everything is now. Yeah. AEW is like, it's ROH just on a huge scale.
Yeah.
And so what Ring of Honor is now, what has the brand Ring of Honor, it's like, it's almost like redundant, because like this is just what this business is now. It is that style of wrestling. Like you can't really be a successful performer without in some way, shape or form being a competent in-ring performer similar to the Ring of Honor style. So that's like, so does ROH have the spirit of ROH? It's like, the whole business does.
Yeah,
but
right.
I would say AEW is more what ROH would have been if it had money and backing and whatever. Like, that's sure. more ROH.
Yeah, yeah. So what is next for Jimmy Jacobs? What do you have planned for the future?
Well, I'm working with Scott D'Amore with his Maple Leaf Pro.
There you go.
We've got a TV starting this summer in Canada on TSN. So that's fun to sit down with Scott again and hammer out TV shows like we used to do. Other than that, my in-ring performing days are maybe done. I don't have any bookings coming up, and I'm not planning on taking any more. I don't know if that's going to change, but that's sort of just where I'm at right now. And beyond that, wrestling wise, I don't know. You know, okay. being away from like doing weekly TV, you know, starting at WWE in 2015, left AEW at the end of 2024, so almost 10 years of doing weekly television. And now, as I am further away from that and further away from being like inside the depths of the wrestling business, its attraction to me is, it's not what it was. Sure. And I don't know what wrestling holds in my future. I'll say this. This is funny, though. This is funny.
Okay.
Before feeling like I feel now, I had stopped watching wrestling. Like, uh-huh. I just stopped, man. Like, I did not like watching it. That started somewhere in, because I used to watch like as much as I could.
Yeah.
Until I got to WWE, and then WWE just like consumed my life. And then I stopped paying attention to everything else. And then I was just paying attention to WWE. Then I was in Impact. It was just Impact. And then AEW was just AEW. And then it was nothing. So I was like, yeah, I've seen enough wrestling for my life. I don't know, man. In the last few weeks, I've been coming up here where the TV is, and watch some Bruiser Bedlam, WWE.
There you go. Wrestling, right.
Like, I wouldn't have done, I think I've watched more wrestling in the past like 2 weeks than I, like, just for fun watching wrestling, than I watched for fun probably in the last 10 years. So in one way, I'm not as gripped by it. You know, in a certain way, I'm not as gripped by it. Like, it doesn't have its claws in me where I feel like I need to take every indie wrestling booking I possibly can, and or else, oh my God, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have that hold on me. But now there's this new, like, enjoyment of watching it coming over me that I haven't had in like a decade. So yeah. Which is to say, I don't know what's going to happen, man.
Yeah. I mean, I know you say, right, you don't know, but is there a chance Jimmy Jacobs will get out there and do convention appearances, signings, things like that? I mean, this is weird era, right? Like, seems like all these guys have independent wrestling figures. There's all these independent toy companies. Could we see Jimmy Jacobs stepping into some of that stuff? Could we see a Jimmy Jacobs figure potentially in the future? Is stuff like that? I mean, I know you're in ring. You're saying is you don't know, but you seem to have, right. You said you're right. Maybe this new joy. Kind of in a different way. I mean, could we see Jimmy Jacobs out there in some different avenues?
So I don't think I was ever over enough to warrant people booking me for conventions. And the history of me being booked for conventions or not validates that. As far as an action figure goes, Rising Stars of Wrestling, I think it's like Action Figures... What's the? I've got two of them. I'm looking at them right now. There's a regular Jimmy Jacobs and there's a Zombie Princess one with the company that made like the ROH action figures a long time ago. What are they called? I forget what they're called. But I do have a action figure.
Yeah, really. So, see, why was I not aware of that? I didn't know Jimmy Jacobs had an action figure.
That speaks to you about how over I
no, 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 no.
Figures Toy Company. Yeah, figurestoycompany.com.
Oh, right. I gotcha. I do remember those now. Yeah.
$20. You can get yourself a Jimmy Jacobs.
There you go.
Action figure.
Always shilling, right? That's part of wrestling.
All right. I don't see any of the cut of that. So
Okay. Well,
just for your house, or I've got a box of him in my closet too. So
So do you have a way, if listeners did want to follow you, to stay current on what you're doing, if something popped up, do you have any kind of social media presence that they could follow you at?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram at the moment. I guess depending when you're listening to this, I'm on Instagram at Jimmy Jacobs X. I still have jimmyjacobs.com live, but I never updated it. Again, you know, it feels like my time in the wrestling business is starting to dwindle. That's what it feels like to me. So if I disappear off social media, that's probably that.
Well, it's time then. I think it's time then to transition to your grumpy old man being snarky at the current product, isn't it? I mean, I think that's the natural progression.
I think I've done enough of that. I think it's time for the joyful old
man. There you go. That's right. Watching Bruiser battle him on YouTube.
That's right. That's
the fun path. I like that. So that makes me happy that you discovered that and are having a good time. You and Truth. Again, as a Midwest guy, I have a soft spot in my heart for that. So much fun. So Jimmy, it's been an honor to talk to you. I have been a fan of yours for a long time. I was an avid Ring of Honor guy in those prime years. So I've been a big fan of yours. And it has been an absolute honor to talk to you, and I appreciate your time and giving it to me. And who knows, maybe we can revisit and talk some more down the road.
Yeah, we should binge watch some Bruiser Bedlam wrestling.
Let's give
our take on it.
Yeah, let's do some watch alongs or something. Yeah,
we can watch Scott Steiner do his crazy 450.
Yeah, then he lands on his feet and then falls. I don't know what that was.
No, but it's pretty cool. You know, it's not the 450s of today, but it's boy, this is in the 80s, man.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if anybody's gonna go face to face with him and ask him what the hell he was thinking of, but.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's a big guy that can do a flip. It's like, it's amazing.
At that time, it was pretty revolutionary. I'm telling you, it was pretty exciting. So, all right. Well, thank you, Jimmy. Stay in touch. Like I said, yeah, we'll, who knows? Well, maybe we'll do a little something else in the future and have a little fun.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Available on all streaming platforms, it's professional wrestling's greatest, largest, privately owned wrestling library. All the classic hits, flips, slams, and pins of yesteryear are on one place. It's Ultimate Classic Wrestling. Check out the Nature Boy Ric Flair, Hulk Hogan, Mr. USA Tony Atlas, Tito Santana, Rick Martel, a who's who of professional wrestling's greatest spotlight stars ever to grace the squared circle, all in one place. Grab the best seat in the house for memories and mayhem on Ultimate Classic Wrestling.
Hey guys, Ray Russell here. Lots of new stuff happening here at WrestleCopia. If you haven't checked out our website at WrestleCopia.com, it's a great way to keep up with the latest episodes of all of your favorite Copia programming, from the Wrestling Memory Grenade to Regional Wrestling with the Territory Talk, the Wrestling Stoop with the legendary Bob Roop, and of course, all of those programs also available at your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And if you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the Copia world, all the latest news, random thoughts, fun videos, pictures, and more, make sure to join the more than 33,000 followers over at facebook.com/wrestlinggrenade. Don't be left out. And last, but definitely not least, it's what keeps the entire machine going. I'm talking about patreon.com/wrestlecopia. We appreciate your support in helping us pay the bills to keep the WrestleCopia Podcast Network running and enabling us to continue to bring you all the quality programming that we offer.
All right, and thank you to Jimmy for coming on and chatting with me. Everyone, go check out some classic Ring of Honor to see prime Jimmy Jacobs in action. All right, guys, follow me on social media. I'm on pretty much all the platforms. Just look up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty or at The Dave Dynasty, and you can find me. Also, be sure to subscribe to me on YouTube for lots of classic wrestling content, plus all my various podcasts. As you heard in the interview, hey, Jimmy Jacobs is watching me on YouTube. You should, too. And guys, don't forget, I do have lots of t-shirts out there, and there are a couple of them that are just for the show specifically, but I am working with a lot of classic, pretty much classic WWA wrestlers to have shirts out there for them. We have shirts for Chris Carter. We have shirts for Stormy Granzig, El Bracero, Dr. Jerry Graham Jr., and there's more to come. Go check those out. You can go to my Pro Wrestling Tees store. Just look up, when you get there, just look up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty there, or there is a link in the notes, and get yourself a shirt and support these guys. It's fun stuff. A lot of these guys, it's their first shirt designs, right, that they've ever had, and it's pretty exciting. So go check that out. Also, go check out all the WrestleCopia Network podcasts. You can find the individual shows on your favorite podcast platforms, or you can visit WrestleCopia.com. Also, be sure to check out my friends at the Ultimate Classic Wrestling Library. Visit ClassicWrestling.net to sign up for your account and then download the Classic Wrestling app on all of your smart devices. All right, guys, another episode coming next week. Stay tuned for the guest on that, but you know it's going to be a fun conversation. We're going to have a good time, and we're just going to get all this nostalgic, right? We're going to talk about fun stuff. Guys, thank you for listening. Thank you for following me. Thank you for subscribing, sharing, doing all those things. I appreciate your support. If you could, whatever podcast platform you are listening to us on, go to that platform, give us a rating and a review. And guys, I know it sounds hokey and everybody asks that, but it's true. Those ratings, those reviews, they help this show in the algorithm. So if someone's listening to another wrestling podcast or something similar, the ratings and reviews help me pop up as a suggested listen or a you might like this one also type thing, which is a lot of help, right? And we can get a lot of eyes on the show. So please just take a moment, go give us a quick rating and review. It doesn't take that long. It really, really helps the show, and I would appreciate it so much. Once again, thank you guys for everything. And remember, wherever you go, whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep on growing.
Fans, we brought you All-Star Championship Wrestling. This is Sam Manager thanking you for being with us and saying until next time, so long, everyone.